the Norwegian team, I mean, are any, it seems they're mostly women of color too.
Oh yes, this is,
they
again,
have,
I'm
like
calm.
A
this
few in intersections going on here.
Oh no. Yes, no. This is but this is the step, you know, in one, I guess it's, you know, one person has to do it and then all of us can follow suit, and if we need to check ourselves before we wreck ourselves, I think that could be the mantra for going on forward. We are just about out of time, and yeah, wanted to thank everyone for listening in. Arab Voices is up next. Thank you, Althea, so much.
Yeah.
Sonia, thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Take care of yourselves. We'll be here next week.
See ya. Happy Friday.
Goodbye.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from People's Food Co-op, a community-owned natural foods cooperative featuring farm-direct organic produce from more than 30 local farms, bulk foods, and a farmer's market every Wednesday year-round. Located at Southeast Tibbetts Street and 21st Avenue in Portland for almost 50 years. Online at peoples.coop.
Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to Arab Voices on Houston's community station, listener-sponsored, commercial-free KPFT 90.1 FM, with live streaming and online archive of previous shows at both kpft.org and arabvoices.net. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. This show is syndicated and it airs on other radio stations in different states in the U.S. Today on Arab Voices, I will air a portion of an event held last week on July 22, 2021, hosted by Demand Progress Education Fund. The event was titled The Blockade of Yemen Continues, Updates on the Crisis and What Congress Can Do About It. The panelists were Hassan Attayeb with Friends Committee on National Legislation, Ilyas Youssef with the Center for International Policy, Shireen Al-Adimi with Michigan State University, and Marcus Stanley with the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. The panelists offered updates on the blockade, ongoing humanitarian crisis, and the U.S. role. They also highlighted stories from the ground in Yemen, discussed recent developments towards a peace deal, and offered perspectives on what role Congress can play. Let's listen in, and the voice you will hear first is that of Hassan Attayeb with Friends Committee on National Legislation, who was also the moderator.
Thank you, Demand Progress, for hosting this event and allowing us to talk about something that's really, really important to the panelists and myself and to so many people, because as you said, it is the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Roughly 6 months into the Biden administration, conditions on the ground remain very desperate. About 80% of Yemen's people are in need of humanitarian assistance. 5 million face death from hunger and malnutrition, and 400,000 children under the age of 5 are expected to die this year from severe acute malnutrition if urgent action is not taken. While the Biden administration announced some, really positive policy changes, including an end to U.S. support for offensive operations in the Saudi-led coalition's war in Yemen, critical elements of that U.S. support remain, and some of the definitions of offensive and defensive. Does offensive operations include any military support for the blockade? Some of those things remain undefined and have not been publicly clarified. There's also been, no confirmation that the U.S. has meaningfully pressured Saudi Arabia to lift the blockade, despite the administration's stated opposition to the restrictions on all these ports of entry. We've seen numerous congressional letters signed by a bipartisan group of over 100 members of Congress. We've gotten very little, very little attention to that, not the responses that we would have hoped for. And unfortunately, the ports of entry are still restricted to commodities. And in May, we saw no fuel enter Hodeida, which is Yemen's largest port. So after 6 months of, very little progress on the humanitarian crisis, there really is a growing frustration among members of Congress and advocates and civil society. And so this event, I think, is really critical. It comes at a very important moment and follows up on our past discussions on this topic and hopes to offer some updates on the blockade, the humanitarian crisis, tries to add some clarity to what the U.S.'s continued role in the war is, and maybe even offer some perspectives for what Congress can do about this situation. With that, I'd like to first introduce Shireen Aladhemi. She's an assistant professor of education at Michigan State University. And since 2015, she's played a very active role in raising awareness about the Saudi-led coalition's war on her country of birth, Yemen, and works to encourage political action to end U.S. support for the war. And I will say that she's also had a big influence on me and has taught me so much about this crisis and what people can do about it. Another friend and colleague, Elias, is the director of the Security Assistance Monitor at the CIP, or Center for International Policy, where he analyzes the impact of U.S. arms transfers and security assistance programs on international security, U.S. foreign policy, and global human rights practices. Yusuf has substantial experience working on armed conflict research, international security, and civilian protection issues, both in DC and in the Middle East. And last but not least, Marcus Stanley is the advocacy director of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Prior to joining Quincy, he spent a decade at Americans for Financial Reform, where he helped direct the efforts of a coalition of 200 organizations on a range of legislative and regulatory initiatives to challenge the power of Wall Street. Before that, he was an economic and policy advisor to Senator Barbara Boxer as a senior economist at the U.S. Joint Economic Committee. While there, he produced War at Any Price, a seminal study on the full costs of the Iraq invasion used to build political support to end the U.S. role in the war. I just wanted to flag for people that Kothar was going to be joining us, but had a family emergency and is unable to attend. But we look forward to this really robust discussion with these amazing panelists. And with that, I'd like to start off the discussion with a question for Shireen. Could you provide everybody here with some context about what's happening with regards to the humanitarian crisis, the blockade, and ongoing negotiations? And is there anything you can tell us about what life is like in Yemen right now on a day-to-day level, as members consider further legislative action on Yemen?
Well, thanks so much for having me, Hassan, and for Demand Progress for hosting us. As Kayvon mentioned, this is a really urgent and dire situation and continues to be for roughly 80% of the Yemeni population, if not more. So what was bad then is worse now. And it's always difficult, I think, for people to understand just how terrible things are in Yemen, but they continue to get even worse. So I just want to remind people that in February, the United Nations agencies warned that 400,000 children under the age of 5 were going to die this year if conditions didn't improve. Here we are in July, and presumably 200,000 children have already died because their needs have not, their most basic human needs have not been met. This is roughly a child every 75 seconds. I don't think this is comprehensible. It used to be a child every 10 minutes, which of course is horrific to think about. And these are children under the age of 5. We're not even talking about the entire population. Most recently, just yesterday, there were some floods that killed 14 people in the south of Yemen. And this, of course, adds further to the humanitarian condition and to destruction of infrastructure and whatnot. Like you said, Hassan, there's been no fuel entering Hodeidah in May, despite the pressure from Congress. You know, the Biden administration has not applied any diplomatic pressure, as far as we know, to the Saudis regarding to lifting the blockade. And so what it means is that because there's not enough fuel entering the country, or really no fuel entering the country at times, and there's a bifurcation of the Yemeni currency, which just hit an all-time record low of one US dollar equaling 1,000 Yemeni riyals. For context, before the war, it was about 250 Yemeni riyals to a dollar. And so the currency was bifurcated between north and south when the central bank was moved from Sana'a to Aden some years back. The government stopped paying government workers their salaries. And now with the crash of the currency, whatever is in the country, people are unable to afford that. So even for humanitarian groups, for example, food baskets have risen in cost by 20% or so. In terms of airstrikes, even though 2021 is has seen low civilian casualties, I mean, there's not that daily bombing that we used to see in Sana'a and in other areas over the years, but areas like Ma'rib in the north and Hejaz also in the north are still seeing targeted and increased airstrikes. So comparing May to June, according to the Yemen Data Project, there's been an increase of 44% of airstrikes, with 34 of those targets that they identified, of the 34 that they've identified, 16 targeted residential areas, 2 targeted farms, as well as private business, civilian car, and road. So the casualties continue to mount. And of course, airstrikes mean most likely U.S.-supported airstrikes by the Saudis and the UAE. The UAE continues to kind of go under the radar, even though they continue to support the secessionists in the south, which complicates the stated goals of restoring Hadi to power. And just yesterday, there was a report that pro-government Saudi commentators were now publicly criticizing the role of the UAE in undermining essentially the Saudi-led effort in Yemen. And they're all but occupying the island of Socotra. You know, there are flights now from the UAE to Socotra. And so the blockade, like I mentioned, continues to be a major factor in Yemen. So the Saudis are still controlling the airspace. They haven't opened Sana'a Airport yet. They are using UN Security Council Resolution 2216 to justify the blockade. Essentially, the UNSC 2216 authorizes Saudi to prevent the entry of ships into Yemen to avoid arms shipments to the Houthis, but they also prevent, you know, they've kind of weaponized this and have weaponized fuel and food and all sorts of things from entering the country, which of course we know is crucially important for a country like Yemen that imports 90% of its food and fuel. So life on a daily basis is extremely difficult. People are having to continue to make decisions that no one should make, like, you know, skipping meals, undergoing exploitation to be able to afford just basic necessities. There's, you know, electricity is an issue, of course, so people can't, you know, escape the heat, or, you know, they can't find enough food to eat. They can't find enough fuel to burn, for the most basic needs, and we're not even talking about hospitals that have been forced to shut down and things like that. Clean water continues to be an issue. I spoke to a friend in northern province of Jope, and he said there's just, you know, no way to get fresh water into the community. There's a shortage of water in that area as well. And so I think whatever we've been seeing over the last few years, have just, the impact has just been worse and have just been compounded, because there's not been any movement. The blockade hasn't been lifted. The airstrikes have stopped and have reduced in certain areas and have increased in areas like Ma'rib. And there have been negotiations between the Houthis and Saudi Arabia, which is great that there are direct negotiations with Oman as a trusted mediator, to be a trusted interlocutor between these two parties. But none of the terms have yet been met. And of course, the Houthis expect Saudi to, you know, they expect all foreigners to leave Yemen, and they also expect Saudis to lift the blockade and to allow the reopening of Sana'a Airport. While the Saudis, of course, are also expecting to reinstate Hadi, but that's seen as no longer seen as a term that can realistically be met. And so now their best hope is to just get some securities for their border protection from the Houthis, to get some guarantees that their border is going to be secure. But beyond that, I think they just have to acknowledge that they've lost this war despite the support of the international community and 6 years of leading this war against the Houthis. So I'll stop there, and I'm not sure if you have any follow-up or if I answered all of the parts of your question.
Shireen, I really appreciate that that description. You paint a really desperate situation on the ground. You paint a picture of ongoing U.S. complicity, and you also paint a picture of a situation that requires more action by Congress and the administration. And that is a great segue into our next panelist, Elias. There's going to be a chance at the end of this conversation for people to weigh in with questions. So Elias, really, really happy that you're here with us. I have, you know, had the pleasure of working with you on a lot of these issues, and really enjoyed, a great report that CIP had put out on this very issue. So many activists, myself included, were really thrilled about the Biden administration's announcement to end U.S. support for offensive operations. But really, a lot of key questions remain. And 41 members of Congress, led by Reps DeFazio and Khanna, wrote a letter to the president early this year. And they had specific questions about what support has been ended, what's the definition of offensive and defensive. And while the State Department eventually did respond, many legislators weren't satisfied with the answers that were given. And a lot of these questions still remain. Furthermore, Tim Lenderking, Biden's special envoy to Yemen, came to the House Foreign Affairs Committee and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee a couple months ago to discuss issues around the blockade, but was really unable to, give much detail about ongoing military support and exactly what ways the U.S. has been applying leverage to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to lift the blockade. And I'm wondering if you could, take us into, some of these answers about, what the CIP report said about ongoing U.S. involvement for the war via maintenance, any intel, logistical support, and just really talk us through that whole, what you all found in your study, and maybe offer some insight on, what support for offensive operations looks like, and, kind of take us through some more of these details that are critical for us to understand what's going on here.
Hassan, thanks very much for that and for the question. It's really great to be here, and thanks to our host for convening this discussion. I don't think there can be enough panels on this topic, so I appreciate it. As Hassan said, I'm the Deputy Director of the Security Assistance Monitor, where I manage a publicly available database tracking U.S. arms sales, security assistance, foreign military training. So as you might expect, the decades-long security partnership between the United States and Saudi Arabia has long been a key area of interest for us, but acutely so since 2015 at the start of Riyadh's intervention in Yemen. I think it's clear from both what Hassan said and what Shireen said that it explains why President Biden's February announcement of a cessation of U.S. support for offensive operations in Yemen was greeted with such fanfare. I think for many, including myself, It offered a bit of hope that the U.S. was finally placing its diplomatic muscle behind efforts to end the conflict rather than enabling it. But I think, as we are all aware, and people on this call especially, executive ambiguity and reticence on the matter has raised serious questions about the practical nature of enduring U.S. support to the Saudi war effort. As Shireen said, with Yemeni still suffering from acute supply shortages brought about by the Saudi blockade and from enduring Saudi airstrikes, sussing out the specifics of what U.S. support looks like and how that can be leveraged to improve the humanitarian situation on the ground, it's all the more important. So specifically, what do we know of U.S. support? What's changed and what remains the same? At a basic level, there have been important changes to U.S. engagement with the Saudi war effort. Days after the president's announcement, CENTCOM said it was suspending targeting assistance, as well as the provision of intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance inside Yemen that Riyadh could reasonably use to identify, select, and strike at targets. The U.S. has continued to refrain from air-to-air refueling of Saudi aircraft, and vitally, the U.S. has suspended a number of arms transfers to the kingdom, including for precision-guided munitions that were proposed for export at the very tail end of the Trump administration. So while those changes are all you know, notable, much of the expansive security cooperation relationship between Washington and Riyadh remains the same. And the U.S. continues to provide vital services to the Saudi armed forces. So firstly, CENTCOM continues to monitor Yemeni territory and provide defensive intelligence and warning to the Saudis, particularly for incoming projectiles directed at the kingdom. I think that given the historically close intelligence relationship between the two countries, more clarity from the administration on broader intel sharing in relation to the conflict would be really useful. Additionally, questions remain on a variety of other arms transfers to Saudi Arabia that seem likely to continue, particularly if they are not designed to interface with fixed-wing aircraft. For example, without further clarity from the White House, I think it's likely that munitions for rotary-wing aircraft, artillery pieces and their ammunition, armored vehicles, and even training could still be making their way to Saudi Arabia. But as Hassan alluded to, I think perhaps most concerningly is the ongoing U.S. maintenance and sustainment support for the Royal Saudi Air Force. For all the money the Saudis have spent on their armed forces, they remain overwhelmingly dependent on foreign assistance to maintain their air fleet. And this is especially true for some of that higher end maintenance and sustainment. And accordingly, the Saudis have spent tens of billions for these services, which, as far as we know, continue to be administered. These maintenance packages have been purchased both through foreign military sales, which are government to government, and as well as through commercial contracts licensed by the State Department. So these contracts are commonly multi-year in nature and can often require the detailing of U.S. government personnel alongside commercial contractors to fulfill. If you look at the report that we put out, we list a few as just examples of ones that we are concerned about. And as an example, a proposed sale from 2019 for I think it was almost $2 billion in aircraft follow-on support and services required the assignment of a contingent of U.S. government personnel in addition to the private contractors. And I'll note that sale in particular was part of a larger package that was actually exempted from congressional review by the Trump administration's use of an invocation of an emergency authority, as many of you may recall from 2019. So in short, U.S. maintenance support to the Saudi warplanes remains indispensable for Riyadh's ability to field its aircraft. Without U.S. support for the bulk of its air fleet, which is predominantly American-made, Saudi Arabia simply could not keep its planes in the sky. So where I see a particular lack of clarity in addition to that is on how the administration interprets the Saudi blockade in the context of its moratorium on support for offensive operations in Yemen. Saudi warplanes remain an integral component of the maritime and air blockade infrastructure that is preventing the transfer of essential goods to Yemen, especially fuel. And it's also worth noting that the U.S. has sold advanced littoral combat ships to the Saudis, though I'm not certain what role, if any, they are playing in the maritime blockade. you know, ultimately, I think what this points to is a wider picture, and what I'm sure this audience is concerned with, which is the degree to which the United States is functionally integral to the Saudi military architecture. America has been the principal engine behind Saudi military developments for more than 80 years now, providing billions in defense equipment, services, and training that have come to define the Saudi defense sector. I'll also add, we've been integral in the development of Riyadh's growing, albeit nascent, indigenous defense industry. And so in this context, the distinction between offensive and defensive support becomes increasingly blurry, particularly when you're talking about an integrated combined arms military like that of the Saudis. So as a starting point, I think this illustrates the need for significantly greater transparency on the part of the administration when it comes to its policy regarding the war in Yemen and its ongoing support to Saudi Arabia in any capacity, particularly given the explicit inquiries from lawmakers in recent months. And at the very least, it would also suggest that the U.S. maintains significant leverage for pressing the royal court to pursue not only good faith peace negotiations, which others have mentioned, but also changes in military policy to include an essential relaxation of the Yemeni blockade. The U.S. has an interest in ending the war in Yemen and stemming its humanitarian toll. And yes, there is some evidence that suggests that pressure exerted thus far is bearing some diplomatic fruit. I hope reports of a reduction in Saudi airstrikes and steps towards a negotiated settlement are true, but I think everyone on this call would agree that we don't have the luxury of time. And any pressure that can be brought to bear now is worth considering, including any influence the U.S. has so far kept in reserve. In the short term, I think this specifically means a relaxation of the blockade, and that should be a prime area of concern for the Biden administration. I'm going to close with this, and I mentioned it because I know it's been an argument that's discussed a lot lately. I know some have been concerned that an exertion of too much pressure vis-a-vis the U.S. military partnership with Riyadh will eventually lead the kingdom to turn elsewhere for its security needs, Russia, China, whoever. I'll just say very briefly that I think these concerns, you know, real though they may be, fail to take into account the degree of dependence that the Saudis still have on the U.S. for their military enterprise. And while such a transition is not impossible, it would represent a generational shift in structures, materiel, doctrines, security architecture that would cost billions at a time when Saudi budgets are already quite strained and take many years to accomplish. So just wanted to note that before I turn back over to you, Hassan.
Wow, thank you so much. That's a really comprehensive overview. Elias, before you jump, there was one thing I wanted to ask while it's fresh in my mind. Now, you talked about this maintenance support and how critical that is to the sustainment of the Saudi warplanes. You know, I was wondering if you could dig into that just a little bit more. You know, we've heard folks like Bruce Riedel talk about it, but in your own words, you know, knowing that there's ongoing maintenance support for Saudi warplanes, I mean, you know, is it possible for them to do their own maintenance? Can you kind of dig into that just a little bit?
Yeah, so, you know, there has been quite a bit of discussion about the ability for the Saudis to go it on their own. And they've made substantial investments over the last, especially the last decade, to sort of create improved defense independence. But at this stage, the Saudis remain inextricably dependent on foreign partners to sustain their air fleet. And what I mean by that is quite simply that the Saudis would not be able to field their aircraft or keep them in the skies for really any period of time were it not for ongoing U.S. support specifically. The Saudis do maintain European fighter jets as well, the Eurofighter among others, but for the most part, the bulk of their fleet remains American F-15s, and they have spent considerably in the tens of billions of dollars to keep American contractors, and in some cases it appears American government personnel, keeping those planes in the sky. And so I don't think it can be overstated. And in that sense, there is a real question about this distinction between offensive and defensive support. I think if you are providing the means for those planes to fly over Saudi skies, and as I mentioned, to provide a component of the maritime blockade, I think this is important to note that a blockade isn't just boats in the water. It's a wider infrastructure that includes aircraft. I think there's a real question as to whether or not that should be considered offensive operations. I mean, the distinction is sort of immaterial in many ways.
That's really insightful. And I encourage our entire audience to, you know, after this panel is over, to dig into Elias's, you know, amazing report from the Security Assistance Monitor. And with that, let's talk about what we can actually do about this. And we have Marcus Stanley from the Quincy Institute, who's with us here. Marcus, you know, you've been doing a ton of advocacy, going to, you know, meeting after meeting with members, talking about these vehicles that we have, you know, that Congress has to take action on this. And I guess, you know, could you go through what's been done on the blockade in Congress so far, you know, both in terms of statements and maybe even legislation, and what still has to be done? I mean, there are a lot of staffers joining us today, and I think they want to know what, you know, what they should be asking their bosses to do on this. And, you know, the picture that Shireen and Elias have painted, you know, kind of points to ongoing U.S. complicity despite the Biden executive order. So I think we'd love some clarity here.
Yeah, so I'll definitely finish with the what do we do question, which I think is really the critical thing for people to take away from today's presentation. But I want to go back a little bit into the legislative history of Congress's attempts to address this war, because it's been considerable. And as I'm sure most of the people on this call know, it started under the Trump administration, where Congress actually did pass a war powers resolution to bring an end to U.S. support for Saudi aggression in Yemen. And that war powers resolution, you know, it was sort of legalistically questioned at the time, because it focused on mid-air refueling and targeting, and there were claims made that these were not acts of war. But of course, under war powers, Congress gets to define what is an act of war under the very general language in the 1973 War Powers Resolution, which I'll talk about more in a minute. And Congress did pass that War Powers Resolution, and it was vetoed by the Trump administration, a veto of arguable constitutionality, I personally believe. But even though that veto was not challenged, that War Powers Resolution, the passage of that War Powers Resolution, still led to the end of mid-air refueling. And it also brought tremendous attention to this issue, and I think helped drive the Biden administration's commitment to ending hostilities in the war. And we also saw during the Trump administration that there were several provisions passed in the NDAA, in the defense authorization legislation, that would have cut off all support, including logistical support for the Saudi military, until there was an end to those hostilities in Yemen. But those were stripped out in conference. They were passed by the Democratic House, but stripped out in conference. So when you look at this very, very vital and forceful legislative action under the Trump administration, you know, you would really have hoped that 6 months into the Biden administration, where we have Democratic control of both houses of Congress, and, you know, there was bipartisan support for these measures in the Trump administration, but I think it's fair to say that in the House in particular, these efforts were associated somewhat with the Democratic Party. We, given the Biden administration's pledge and all three branches of government under one party, you would have hoped that things would really have changed on the ground in Yemen. And as we've heard this whole time, they really haven't. And what we have seen in the first 6 months is some real attempts by Congress to sort of question and pressure the Biden administration, and at least to ask, you know, what's happening? What does your pledge really mean? Why hasn't it been executed on? And we saw, I think you actually mentioned some of these, Hassan, in your introduction, with the questions to Lender King, which he was really unable to answer in his confirmation. And also very important, the letter from led by Representative DeFazio and others with many signers that really put tough questions to the administration about what's going on here and what kind of continued support is going on, and why haven't these offensive operations come to an end. And as I think a couple people have noted, the administration response was really unsatisfactory. I'm going to drop in the chat an Intercept article about that that goes into some detail, and I think all of us panelists have the text of the letter, but it was a very evasive, legalistic response, which said that, as Elias noted, there were a few weapon systems that were cut off, that were not sold, and the U.S. had increased its so there was suspension of some sales of munition. There was increased humanitarian aid, but a lot of the letter talked about continued logistical support to Saudi forces for defensive purposes, and really tried to justify that, and really didn't answer the question of how are we stopping aggressive action here, as opposed to just engaging in diplomacy while this stalemated and bloody war grinds on. So what you really saw in that letter, I think, is a reluctance that the administration is reluctant to really use our full leverage with Saudi Arabia. And that is really the key dynamic driving a lot of what we're seeing both on the ground and in Congress. And one thing that I talk about with people is, you know, when I'm in these meetings, is Congress has raised this question. Congress has posed these questions to the administration multiple times. There was also a letter from Senator Warren, and gotten unsatisfactory answers. So now is the time for action. But what's pushing against that action, I think, is that administration reluctance to really kind of prioritize ending this war over having a nice relationship with Saudi Arabia. And we're seeing, I think, in part coming from the administration, a lot of legalisms about defensive versus offensive operations, which Elias did a really good job of talking about why those really can't be separated. A lot of legalisms about what can and can't be done under a War Powers Resolution. I'll talk about that in a minute. But frankly, I think, you know, Congress has constitutional and statutory authority to do what it wants under a War Powers Resolution. And a lot of these things are distractions. And we're also seeing more rhetoric being floated, faulting the Houthis for their own flaws and their own human rights violations, which may well be true, but I think it's very important to separate ending this war and its impact on civilians from the back and forth about the faults of both sides. You know, when you have a really bloody, grinding, stalemated war engaging, you know, you've got to prioritize that is killing innocents. You've got to prioritize ending that war, and you can have a process for discussing the diplomacy between the two sides afterwards. So in terms of current things that can be done, I think there's sort of two broad channels. One is to use must-pass legislation, such as appropriations legislation and things like the National Defense Authorization Act, to put in provisions that cut off funding or cut off authorization for the war. And I would note that there is a provision in the current defense appropriations-based text released by Representative McCollum that would cut off support for Yemen operations, although I think it lacks some of the specificity regarding the logistical support to the Saudi Air Force that we've seen in some previous provisions. But I think it's a very positive provision that should lead people to support this defense appropriations bill. We haven't really seen the NDAA yet, but we can hope for something there. And we can hope for perhaps there's nothing in the state and foreign operations provisions now, but we can hope for something in SFOPs, perhaps an amendment. But I think one thing that is true about this channel of using individual provisions in these big must-pass bills is, first of all, they can be cut out in a back room. I mean, that's what we saw. There were multiple such provisions passed by the House under the Trump administration, and they were removed in Congress. And the second is they really don't shine a light on the issue in the same way. They're very sort of inside baseball technique, which is fine. You know, we're all like within DC, I guess we're all sort of inside baseball people a little bit, but they don't bring the public pressure and the public spotlight on the administration in terms of saying, hey, you know, this is a humanitarian catastrophe, children are dying, you promised to end it, it hasn't ended. Instead they sort of submerge the issue in big pieces of legislation that raise lots and lots of issues, you know, around the world. So the other avenue is a war powers resolution. And a war powers resolution, I think, really has the strength that it does shine that spotlight and it does force the question. And it's something that can be brought to the floor by a single member in a privileged status. So it's something that, you know, you're not dependent on sort of leadership backing you up on. Now, there are some issues in terms of the war powers clock being suspended because of COVID, but I don't think that can really continue indefinitely, and it particularly can't continue if it's seen as an excuse for not dealing with Yemen. You know, if there is a push to do a war powers resolution and leadership tries to quash it that way, I don't really think that is feasible. And I think we're also seeing, I think in part because the administration's reluctance to really put pressure on Saudi Arabia here, or the apparent reluctance, we are seeing these sort of legalisms popping up about the war powers resolution, sort of claiming that that U.S. activity in Saudi Arabia does not rise to the level of an introduction of U.S. forces into that war. And that you know there's some legal issue with having there be a war powers resolution. You know, the actual text of the 1973 War Powers Act is very broad, and Congress gets to define those terms. And just a quote from that text of the 1973 War Powers legislation, the term introduction of United States armed forces includes the assignment of members of such armed forces to command, coordinate, participate in the movement of, or accompany regular or irregular military forces of any foreign country or government where such military forces are engaged in hostilities. So, is it the case we, as Elias said, you know, there are U.S. military personnel involved in the sustainment and provisioning of Saudi planes that are doing strikes in Yemen. Does that involvement involve coordinating or participating in the movement of? You know, to me, I think there's a very obvious argument that if you're refueling a plane and repairing a plane so that it can take off and bomb somebody, that's participating in the plane's movement. And we also saw, by the way, we saw exactly these kind of arguments about mid-air refueling and these kind of legalisms raised in the 2018 War Powers Resolution. But once the War Powers Resolution moved forward and got real support, they quickly cut off the mid-air refueling because they sort of had to examine their activity and the areas that made them most vulnerable to that War Powers Resolution. So Congress can write a resolution as broadly as it likes. It can define these terms for that are there on the introduction of U.S. armed forces. And it would seem to me that those terms really would encompass what we're seeing, what Elias described in terms of U.S. involvement in Saudi Arabia. So I do think a war powers resolution has, even though these other avenues are very important in terms of pieces of must-pass legislation, I think a war powers resolution has a lot of advantages in really forcing the question and shining a light on this issue.
Marcus, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts. And I see there's been a bunch of questions in the chat. I got one that I think Elias is best suited to answer this first one. So I want you to break down for us, if you can, you know, how many U.S. aircraft maintainers and people, you know, doing this, you know, maintenance and logistical support are uniformed personnel versus contractors. I think it's kind of I think any clarity around that would be super helpful if you can provide that.
Yeah, I'll try my best here, because I think, and this is a point that my program makes persistently about almost all aspects of U.S. security cooperation, is that there just really is a lack of transparency to make strong statements on the issue. But I think that we know enough to be a little speculative here. For example, we've seen a number of notifications for arms sales to Congress that indicate there are going to be hundreds of contractors and a handful of U.S. personnel. You know, for example, there was a foreign military sale, I believe, in 2018, that made explicit mention of, you know, it was a sale for maintenance of rotary aircraft that made mention of 320 contractors and one government personnel. There was another for the one that I mentioned a contingent of U.S. government personnel and likely dozens more contractors. But I think it's also important to remember that those contractors are there either through a government-to-government sale, which is negotiated directly with any given administration, or through direct commercial sales that are licensed by the State Department. So, you know, obviously there may be some legalese with regards to the complicity when comparing a contractor to a uniformed personnel, but ultimately there are Americans there in a variety of capacities aiding the Saudi war effort. And I'll also add that beyond that, the U.S. maintains a robust military presence in the kingdom, whether that's through defense attachés, the U.S. military training program there. And so, you know, I don't want to mislead people in thinking that there are just one or two people doing this. I think that it's important to remember this is a whole of government approach that has gone on for decades to support the Saudi military. And yes, that includes uniformed individuals who could be aiding in the maintenance of aircraft, but it's much bigger than that.
Thank you so much. And if I may, I'd like to add that Rep. Ro Khanna was able to pass an amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act in FY 2021 that would do a report on U.S. military support and defense articles, you know, going to support the blockade and restrictions on ports of entry. Now, we're probably going to get that report from the Government Accountability Office in, you know, the early part of next year. I'm assuming December or January, possibly January 2022. So, you know, things are in the works, but it's not fast enough, and we need answers way sooner. I see there are several great questions in the chat here. There was one here that I think is really important. This is from Bert. How does the proposed National Security Powers Act, recently introduced by Senators Murphy, Sanders, and Lee — I'll just note that they are the people that introduced the Yemen War Powers Resolution originally that passed in the Senate — you know, how does that affect the current congressional strategy for a new Yemen war powers? You know, do we need to pass that before we can do a war powers? Maybe Marcus can kind of take us through maybe even what's in the National Security Powers Act, and where does that leave us on the Yemen question?
Well, I think it's really a mistake to think that, you know, the National Security Powers Act you just introduced 2 days ago has some really great things in it. It sort of strikes at some of the abuses of executive war powers we've seen over the past couple decades, like stretching AUMF's authorization of military force to, you know, last forever and justify all kinds of things that weren't in the original AUMF, declaring national emergencies to facilitate all kinds of aggressive activities, including sanctions against other countries, arms sales that are then used in hostilities, even if U.S. forces are not involved, you know, our weapons are. The NSPA really sort of sets up a streamlined procedure to force congressional involvement in all those activities, and it tidies up some elements of the War Powers Act. It sunsets authorizations of military force. It ties funding directly to congressional approval in cases of hostilities. So there's really good things in there. But I think it would be a big mistake to think that the introduction of this new legislation means that the current congressional war powers are somehow not usable. The current congressional war powers are very usable. As I said in my first remarks, there's a very broad definition of introduction of U.S. forces that can be used in the 1973 War Powers legislation. It's really just a matter of Congress's willpower to use that legislation and to to craft war powers resolutions that bind the administration, and frankly to go to court if the administration denies that it violates those war powers resolutions. Congress has those powers. They're in the Constitution. They're in the 1973 statute. We don't need to pass anything new in order to exercise those powers. And so the NSPA, while it's great, and addresses things like arms sales and sanctions and national emergency declarations that aren't addressed in war powers, we still have our war powers to use, whether or not that passes.
Thank you so much. Super helpful. There's another question here I wanted to flag. This is another one by Bert. How do we build a more coordinated, sustained, and powerful movement at the grassroots level to make the Yemen crisis a social issue that moves public opinion in the U.S. and builds grassroots pressure on the government to stop all support for the war? How do we build more momentum? If I could, I wanted to briefly touch on that, is that when I first started working on this, I didn't know much. Shireen, it was actually my first introduction to the crisis in Yemen. And we, at that point, we really hadn't forced votes. We didn't do that first Yemen War Powers vote. And that was kind of my introduction, is working on that War Powers resolution on what people called the forgotten war. And I'm wondering if folks could maybe speak to that, how we build some more momentum here, because we had a lot under Trump, and now we have Biden in power, we have Democrats controlling the House, Democrats controlling the Senate, and this issue feels a bit stuck. So what can we do to move this conversation forward? I open it up to any of the panelists if they want to chime in.
I could chime in here. Thank you for that question. This is the interesting thing here. This is the moment to really not get bogged down with all of the politics that we know can happen and the technicalities. And I heard Marcus say, Congress should really seize the opportunity now. And I just want to remind people that back in 2015 and 2016, when this war started under the Obama administration, there's very little motivation by Democrats to do much about this topic. And now it's starting to feel like they're accepting certain responses from the administration that they wouldn't have accepted under Trump. And so I think the bottom line here is that we are involved in, what many have called a genocide, an ongoing genocide. That's what happens, when you're blocking fuel and food to people who desperately need it. It's not a fair fight. You can talk about the Houthis and their crimes against civilians, but, they don't even have a single aircraft, let alone an international community that's behind the Saudi-led coalition. And so we, the United States, is complicit in every aspect of this war, have been complicit in the genocide of the Yemeni population since 2015. And the urgency seems to be lost sometimes in Congress and among others. I think we'll be judged very critically and harshly by history, but really we're being judged now. People are dying now. In this last hour, how many children have already perished? How many kids have already died? And for us Yemeni Americans, it's been very frustrating because nothing has changed on the ground except that things have gotten worse. And yet the administration seems to be playing these semantics and explaining that, it's not defense, it's not offensive, it's defensive now. But at the end of the day, we're still supporting the Saudi-led coalition. They are still our allies. If a non-ally was involved in a war as egregious as this, we would be sanctioning them. We would maybe even wage war against them. Let alone support them with weapons and intelligence and all of that over the years. And so I think we really just need to be bringing up these issues as citizens, as taxpaying people here in this country, saying this shouldn't be happening in our name. Congress won't feel the need to do anything unless they're hearing from their constituents in town halls, in letters and emails, to continue that pressure up and to let them know that we are watching their reaction. We saw that momentum build under the Trump administration, and it does not need to be fizzled out now that there's a Democratic president. This is a third administration now waging war in Yemen, and we should be very aware of our responsibility toward our fellow human beings in Yemen.
I'll just add to that very briefly, and Shireen said it better than I could, so I won't dig as much into that, but I will say that on this issue of whataboutism with regards to Houthi IHL violations, I think when it comes to the American context, we just don't have the leverage over the Houthis that we have with the Saudis. And if I were talking to the Omanis or the Iranians, I would be encouraging them to do everything they can to limit any sort of civilian harm on the part of their ally or partner. But the reality is the U.S. has access to really only a handful of parties to this conflict, and anything that they're not doing to improve IHL performance, or I should say, mitigating civilian harm, that is on us. And so I'm just to answer that question about, you know, what about the Houthis? I sort of think it's irrelevant in our context.
Elias, thank you so much. And Shireen, thank you so much. Just really critical questions here. Yeah, I mean, I think as I have conversations about this issue, a lot of people say, well, what's going on, you know, with the Houthis? Are we holding them accountable? And I always ask, what leverage after 6 years of war, blockade, airstrikes, targeting, you know, in large part civilians and civilian infrastructure, you know, what do we have left? I see Marcus wanted to maybe jump in and kind of cover some of this as well. I invite him to join.
Thanks, Hassan. So yeah, I just wanted to say this issue of, you know, what about the other side, and they're not perfect and they're also doing bad things. You know, this is kind of like what we see in Afghanistan with the Taliban, and frankly also what we saw with the North Vietnamese in Vietnam. You have a long, grinding, stalemated war that we clearly cannot bring to an end, that is killing civilians and killing innocent civilians. And we have the power to end that war, and in this case, by influencing the Saudis. And it might be the case that end to the war is not the perfect ending that we would have wanted. You know, the North Vietnamese committed human rights violations, the Taliban clearly. But step one to changing somebody's behavior is to end the war, to end conflict, because people, you know, war leads to the killing of civilians, war leads to human rights violations, war leads both sides to be even darker and more brutal than they otherwise would be. And instead of making excuses not to end the war by just sort of finger pointing and saying the other side is bad too, you know, you have a moral obligation to end that war. And it's clear the Saudis aren't going to end that war through victory and bringing peace that way, just like we weren't going to bring peace to Vietnam by somehow getting the North Vietnamese to surrender. So let's move forward and end this war and discuss these things after. And a second question I just wanted to talk about, because it's so outrageous. Sorry for jumping in on this one, but this is Daniel Martin's question about how we were involved in Yemen to fight al-Qaeda. This is just shows the craziness of U.S. policy in the Middle East, because yes, we were doing strikes in Yemen to fight al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, but guess who else is an enemy of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula? The Houthis. And actually, we saw charges from Al Jazeera in 2018. There was an article saying that the Saudis were actually teaming up with al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula in order to fight the Houthis. And this is, we've seen similar kinds of things in Syria, where we went in to fight ISIS, supposedly, and that was our justification, but we ended up financing people, we ended up fighting people who were ISIS's enemies. And this is really, it's something I didn't mention before, but it's Quincy has done a lot of work on this, that because of how close our relationship is to Saudi Arabia, we get entangled in a lot of things in the Middle East that are absolutely not in our national interests. You know, because we are so entangled with Saudi Arabia, we are in this war in Yemen, which is not related to our national interest. We are fighting the Houthis, who are enemies of our enemies, enemies of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And we may even be supporting the Saudis at the same time as they're supporting al-Qaeda. So until we get like more distance on the Saudis, and until we start saying that pursuing our human rights and values interests, and frankly, our national interests in combating things like Al-Qaeda are have a higher priority than our relationship with Saudi Arabia, we're going to get dragged into these crazy situations.
What you just heard was a portion of the event titled The Blockade of Yemen Continues, Updates on the Crisis and What Congress Can Do About It. It was held on July 22, 2021, and was hosted by Demand Progress Education Fund. For more information on that, visit the website demandprogress.org. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.
Portland, Oregon.
Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. Octavia Butler died at the age of 58 in 2006. At the time of her death, she'd published 16 books, with another volume of uncollected stories published posthumously. The author of several acclaimed science fiction and fantasy novels, most notably Kindred and The Parable of the Sower, her reputation has only grown in the 12 years since her death. While a collection of interviews was published in 2009, very few audio conversations exist today. Richard A. Lupoff and I conducted two of those conversations.